Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
Well, hello everyone. This is Randall Libero, and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. We broadcast each week on the premier channel for transformational talk radio on the internet, Seventh Wave Network, online at seventhwavenetwork.com. That's where you're listening through right now. As you know, in this program, movies are changing the way we think, live, and dream. So each week we showcase today's independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And this week, we're going to do a program on my favorite subject about movies, creating a story and screenplay. So all of you aspiring screenwriters out there, listen up. The show is for you. And I have as my very special guest, Mr. Ray Morton, who is a writer, author, and script consultant, and a graduate of New York University's Tisch School of the Arts and the American Film Institute. And Ray is also a senior writer for Script magazine and pens the Meet the Reader and Legends of Screenwriting columns. And Ray has also written a co-written a number of produced teleplays, and served as a story consultant on Showtime's groundbreaking sitcom Brothers. And as a story analyst, he's read and evaluated feature film screenplays for Columbia Pictures, Castle Rock Entertainment, Paramount. His bio is pretty long here. So we're going to talk today about a couple of things. Ray is also the author of a couple of books, and his most recent book, which is about the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Steven Spielberg's classic movie, which was released in 1977. So we're going to be talking about the movie Close Encounters and the making of that. We'll talk about Ray's book. And we're also going to be talking about the craft of screenwriting in the current state of the art. So first of all, Ray, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate
it. Yeah. Well, it's, I've been looking forward to this interview for a few months now. The first part of the show, in the first half hour, we're going to be discussing screenwriting. In the second half hour, we're going to be talking about the book Close Encounters that's recently released from Ray. If you want to find out more about Ray Morton, raymorton.com. There's a link right on my website at spiritoffilm.net. So, Ray, you have a pretty extensive background in both, both writing and film, and I just wanted to just kind of start off with talking about where the current state of the art in terms of screenwriters are in the film business. Recently we had the writer strike in Hollywood.
Yes.
And what is the kind of repercussions of that strike in terms of the screenwriting industry right now? What's your take on that?
Well, right now, it's really interesting. The industry is in a real state of limbo right now because there was also the possibility of a Screen Actors Guild strike. So things slowed down quite a bit, both in the run-up to and then throughout the writer's strike, which was several months ago now. And the writer's strike lasted 100 days. And in that time, very few films were put into production, and a lot of TV series were either cut short or canceled altogether or just suspended for the following year. So there was this anticipation that there was going to be a lot of catch-up once the strike ended and that there'd be a lot of work for screenwriters. And after the 1988 strike, another thing that happened was there was a big boom in spec script sales, and people anticipated that happening as well. As it turns out, that hasn't really been the case. Because there is the potential for a Screen Actors Guild strike, most TV shows have gotten back up and running, but not nearly as many features have gone into development or production, and the spec market has been really flat. So it's been kind of a doldrum time, I'm afraid.
Wow. I interviewed Peter Deckham some months ago, and that program is in my archives, and he was talking about the changing scope of what's happening in Hollywood as a whole and how much money it costs to create films nowadays and marketing.
Yes.
So looking at someone who wants to break in as a screenwriter, and of course, if you're a screenwriter, one of the main things, and we'll go into that a little bit, about getting your script read by someone like Ray, and you can find out about more on that on his website. But you know, it seems that because of the proliferation of the internet, not only how that's affecting Hollywood, but also there's a lot of opportunity right now which is shifting away from Hollywood, don't you think, in terms of writers actually able to make films? Is that are you seeing more of that in your work?
Well, not specifically in my work. I tend to work more with the things that go to the mainstream channels right now. But I think what you're pointing out is very true. With the internet, especially distribution, YouTube has been amazing. People can distribute their own. You're seeing a lot more people trying to do things on their own. And, of course, with digital video equipment, it's cheaper than ever. You don't really have lab costs anymore. Most people can edit on their home computers. So there is definitely a rise in that. I would not say that it is a major force yet, but it is building. And what you are seeing is, for directors especially, YouTube shorts and internet shorts are becoming a great audition piece. It's not quite the case for writers just yet, because unfortunately a short film, a short screenplay, I guess I should say, doesn't really demonstrate the skills that people looking to hire writers would necessarily go for. They're always going to want a longer piece. So for screenwriters right now, it's still a little bit on the traditional side. You still do have to write some sort of spec or sample script and still get it read by people if you're looking to be hired to do things. If you're looking to make your own film, of course, all you've got to do is write it to your own satisfaction.
And I just want to point out for our audience at Ray's website, raymorton.com, there's a lot of great articles to read that Ray has penned across you know, his career working as a writer for Script Magazine, of course, also, I think, just for putting information out there. So read some of that information that's on his website, because that'll give you some great pointers, things to stay away from, the type of scripts that are Hollywood may be looking for. Of course, if you don't know about Script Magazine, it's scriptmag.com. It's the premier magazine for the craft and business of screenwriting. I read it all the time. There's some terrific articles in there every month. Ray, what has changed over, say, the course of the past 20 or 30 years since, of course, when Close Encounters came out, we're talking about 30 years ago. Has the industry changed that much in terms of someone wanting to break in as a new screenwriter, either for television and or for films?
Right. The basic process hasn't changed all that much. What has changed is 15 to 20 years ago, and maybe even as recently as 10 years ago, there was a much more thriving spec script market. And a spec script, for people who don't know, is a script that you write yourself. Nobody hires you to do it. Nobody commissions you to do it. And then you use that script to try to get screenwriting work. You either try to sell that script to a producer or a studio, or use it as a writing sample for people to hire you to do work that they want you to do. 15, 20 years ago, the spec script market was booming. And by that, what I mean is people would write a script, and if you could get it to an agent and get it distributed, they were selling for incredible amounts of money. It started out when $500,000 was a lot of money and went up to $4 or $5 million. And that's the era of Shane Black and Joe Esterhaus, names like that that people know. The big change in the last 2 years is that that market has diminished quite a bit for people to sell original screenplays that then get made into films. But otherwise, the process is pretty much the same. You still have to write a script that will show off your talent, show off your ability, get people's attention, and then you have to get it to the right people. And by that, usually we would mean an agent or a manager who then get it to studios or producers. That system pretty much hasn't changed. You still have to kind of go through those channels. What has changed, and I think for the better for screenwriters, is there's a little bit more access to the agent-manager world than there used to be. Previously, you pretty much had to be recommended by someone the agent already knew, and that was a tough one if you were somebody who was coming from someplace where you didn't have a lot of contacts. Now you have things. There are a lot more websites. A lot of management companies will, like Bender Spink and places like that, will allow you to submit your work online, so you have a better chance of getting it read by those gatekeepers than you did maybe 15 or 20 years ago. Many screenplay contests now, the prize is that they will, if the script wins, they'll connect you with an agent or a manager, and those things weren't so much available 15, 20 years ago. So your chances of getting your foot in the door in the representation area are a lot better than they used to be.
Yeah, and of course there's conferences to attend where you can make direct contacts with agents and entertainment lawyers, and I've seen a lot more of that over the past decade.
Yes.
So there is, in some regard, you know, in terms of the spec script market, the industry is drying up a little bit, but in terms of making contacts and connections to people who can, you know, maybe get you a sale, that I think has improved a lot.
Yes.
Because of the internet now and you know, submitting scripts and contests. So, I mean, I think it's a great time for writers. I think there's a lot of opportunity out there. And of course, as always, networking, industry contacts, you know, schmoozing, you know, all that kind of a thing. That's still something that I recommend to everybody. Don't just think you can just, you know, hang out somewhere and write your script and, you know, maybe send it around. You really need to get out among industry people. So any kind of events, there's a lot of things going on all over the place in any major city. We're here in Phoenix, and there's all sorts of things happening. Plus, there's organizations. Here in Phoenix, there's the Phoenix Screenwriters Guild, where you can, you know, hang out with other screenwriters and trade ideas and stay inspired. And I highly recommend those things as well. Ray, let's talk a little bit about script consulting. You've been reading and analyzing scripts for a long time, and you work with the Final Draft Script Expert Service. Final Draft is my favorite. Nothing better than Final Draft. There's a lot of programs out there, but I think just because of, you know, so many parts of how that software works, and of course the Script Expert Service is great. You can find out more about getting your script read, of course, on scriptmag.com. There's a link right on the front page about Script Expert Service. Talk a little bit about what you do as a reader and a story consultant.
Okay. It's pretty much the same process whether I'm working for a producer or a company or working for something like Script Expert, which is available to people outside of the industry as well. But the process is basically the same. I get a script and I read it, and then formulate an opinion. And that opinion, you know, encompasses a couple things. Like, number one, is the story interesting? Does it have good characters? All of the creative things that you would normally want to assess a script for. And then also what its chances would be in the marketplace right now. And I don't necessarily mean by that that you could sell it for $5 million. What I mean is producers look for a lot of things when they're looking for a script. They are looking for a good story. That's very important. They are looking for good characters. That's very important. But a script also has to be castable, and that's a place where there's a sort of a reality check that has to come in. A big studio is going to want to cast it with a big movie star. The power of the movie star is kind of waning a little bit right now, but it's still an important factor. So the script is going to have a character that can be played by a high-profile actor. Smaller companies, that's not quite as important, though it is still important. But ultimately what I'm saying is you're looking for a dynamic role or several dynamic roles in a script. That's an important thing. The script also has to be producible. And some people have wonderful imaginations, but the scripts they write would cost $500, $600, $700 million to produce. And sometimes that can be taken care of with a rewrite, and sometimes it can't be. So you have to assess that as well. And then you also have to assess things like its genre viability. By that, what I mean is most Hollywood studios and production companies, and even a lot of independents, they have a lot of trouble with mixed genre type films. So they, if it's a comedy, they want to know that it's a straightforward comedy. If it's an action piece, they want to know, does it fulfill the requirements of those genres? So you have to assess those things as well. Once you've done the assessment in your mind, you then prepare a formal written report that essentially analyzes the script from all areas. You analyze story, story construction, premise, you know, characters, dialogue, the writing, the quality of the writing, and then its marketplace potential, its suitability for a particular company, if you're reading for a particular company, and things like that. Usually for a production company, that's as far as I go. If I'm reading for a service like Script Expert, a lot of times clients will request that you give them notes on how to improve the script. And so then you may spend some time coming up with a list of notes, usually 4 to 5 pages of notes, to help them do a rewrite to make the script better. Sometimes I will do that for producers as well, but in the world of screenwriting and script analysis, that's a separate function. You don't need to do that automatically as a script reader. The producer will engage you as a consultant on occasion to basically just tell me how to make this script better. So that's basically the overview.
Would you, for writers, I've heard some stories about screenwriters actually writing a treatment and selling the treatment. Has that ever occurred to you in terms of recommending that to anyone, or just will agents or entertainment lawyers or anybody ever look at a treatment rather than a script? That's a question that comes up sometimes.
Right. The answer is you never really know. Sometimes they might, sometimes they won't, depending on the situation. The good rule of thumb to keep in mind is people who sell movies, you'll hear often people went in and I pitched the idea and they bought it.
Right.
Or I wrote a treatment and they bought it. Most of the people who that happens to are people who have some sort of track record already. The reason is this. Ideas are great, and ideas are very important, and a pitch and a treatment pretty much will present an idea. But execution is also incredibly important. And a studio may buy a pitch from you. They may buy a treatment from you, but they would prefer to see the full script from someone they don't know. You know, if a well, high-profile screenwriter who has an incredible track record pitches an idea, the studio may commission it knowing full well that that person's going to be able to execute the idea to a satisfactory conclusion. If you kind of come in off the street and do that, they have no idea if you're going to have the capability to do it or not. So unless you've already had some success, my feeling is you probably always want to try to go for the full screenplay. I think it's important if you're going to be a screenwriter, you have to really be able to write all phases of the project, from a pitch to a treatment, all the way through to a screenplay, because it is, after all, what the job is.
Right. So if you're a writer, and I think a good first step is writing a synopsis and a treatment, and then from there you understand where your script is structured from, and then, of course, get the screenplay finished. Use final draft,
and, oh, absolutely,
and you know, and get and keep, you know, as I said, you know, get pointers, read, talk to other, and if you can make, I even had a friend of mine who had so many great ideas, and I said, you know what, just get to know some screenwriters, and just, you know, maybe they'll mentor you or something, and that's exactly what he did. He got to know a few well-established screenwriters, and he just got to meet them. I think he went to a couple of conferences. And he got to know, I'm not going to say who it is, because that would,
sure,
I don't want to have that guy besieged by request, but he took one of his ideas and actually worked on him with a screenplay, and, you know, that helped that beginning writer's career. So, I mean, that's another approach. Again, industry contacts. I can't say, you know, enough about that, mm-hmm, as well as, you know, learning your craft the best way you can. Ray, there has been a kind of a shift in some regards in terms of production, and we discussed that just earlier. So if a writer today wrote a really good screenplay and he thought, well, I have a choice, I could pitch it to an agent and I can get an entertainment lawyer, or maybe I can get some friends together and make a small, you know, low-budget film based on my screenplay, or another approach is, you know, maybe make a sort of a trailer as if this is what the film would look like. And so you could pitch it as, here's the script and here's a a trailer, which so they can actually get a visual idea, and it's a well-produced trailer, which you can put up on the internet. Have you ever heard of anybody having a success story where they have actually some film as well as a script and pitching it that way?
Right. I would say that up until now, there has been a little bit of success that's come from a few people that way, but not as screenwriters. Those tend to be better showcases for directors. Here's the thing about screenwriting, and we used to call it, I worked for a company one time, and we sponsored a screenplay contest, and it was so interesting because people would send in their scripts, but then a certain percentage of people would send in what we called the bells and whistles. And I remember one script was a vampire script that the person actually sent in a small hand-carved coffin. And when you opened the coffin, a bat sprung out on a spring. It was terrifically entertaining. Unfortunately, the script wasn't. And I guess my feeling about stuff like that is this. For screenwriters, the most important thing you need to do is to write a really, really good script. Those other things can definitely help, but if the script itself isn't there, they're not going to make any difference. No one can tell from a 3-minute short film whether the script itself is any good. What they can tell is if the 3-minute film is good. It may certainly present the premise, and someone may say, boy, I really like that premise, I want to read the script. But ultimately, you've still got to deliver the goods with the screenplay. If you're interested in being a director or a writer-director, I would say things like that are probably a good place to put some of your energy. If your interest is primarily in screenwriting, I would say just work on the script. If the script is good, it's going to get attention. And if it's not good, everything else you do isn't going to help it.
Well said. I've had some people ask me that question because, you know, it always kind of comes up in conversations, you know, I can make a trailer and let's sell it that way.
Yeah.
Let's just hypothetically take an example. I'm a screenwriter. I wrote a really good script. I've had it read. I've had it, you know, analyzed by someone like you. And they've gotten some amazing, you know, responses back to say, this is an outstanding piece of work. You're a first-time screenwriter. This is like just like you've been writing for years. I mean, the script is terrific. It's a great idea. It's high concept, everything. Do you think someone just taking that script as a first-time writer, or maybe he's written a handful of screenplays, and it's good to have a body of work that you can show as well.
Yes,
that's another good point. Have like 3 or 4 scripts to show, you know, that you're consistent in wanting to be a writer. So someone has this really good script. What would be the recommendation that you would say to that person if they've continually gotten, this is an amazing script, you've read it, maybe someone has read it, maybe, you know, a screenwriter has even read it and said, this is outstanding. Where would you tell that person to go next?
Okay, good question, actually. There's a few options. I mean, ultimately, it depends on what you want to do with the script. But if your goal is to get the script to a major production company or studio to get them to acquire it for production, you know, as opposed to you're going to go make it yourself or something like that, you still need it to be submitted through proper channels, and that means an agent or a manager. One of the things I kind of didn't clarify a while ago was 20 years ago, the whole manager thing didn't exist. If you had a manager, it was a business manager. Managers now are a really interesting wrinkle in the representation field. An agent is strictly that. An agent represents you and your work and submits it to proper channels, and that's pretty much it. I mean, there's a lot of involved in that, but that's pretty much the function of an agent. A manager is someone who handles your entire career, and most managers nowadays are producers as well, or they have some sort of angle into production. So I would say the first thing you would really want to find is a manager at this point. And often a manager can hook you up with an agent who you would need to do any sort of business deal. And you can meet managers in a bunch of different ways. Personal contacts are probably still the most direct and the best. So if you know someone who has a manager who's willing to recommend you, that's probably still the most direct way in. You can meet managers at many conferences. There are, as you mentioned this before, and I was glad that you did, there are a lot of events now where you can meet representatives, managers and agents. Script Magazine sponsors an event called Take a Meeting, where you, and it's like this in this wave of, they call them, pitch meetings and things. You go in, you sign up for a time, and you can actually sit down with a representative and pitch them your ideas. And people do get a lot of traction off of things like that. So that's another way you can do it. Many management companies have websites as well that allow you to submit material. So those would be sort of the three ways: personal contact, some sort of script event where you can meet people, or just screenplay conference where you can meet people, or through the website submissions. Another way to do it is to enter your script in a contest. There are many contests out there, but some of the contests, the prize is that they will put you together with an agent or a manager. And if your script is really good, I think it's probably worth the entry fee to try it.
And another thing I can recommend is there's some conferences and parts of the conferences that teach you how to pitch your idea to someone. And so getting good at pitching your idea, where you can do it in just a few minutes, that way you give them the core concept of your film or your script, and you can communicate it well. And I can tell you, enthusiasm and the ability to do something well, like pitch a story, can go a long way for someone's career. I've done it a few times myself, and also I've seen some good results from that, and I've heard good results from people once they learned the ability to do something like that. Well, Ray, we're about at the halfway point, and we're going to shift gears here and talk about your Close Encounters book.
Okay.
All right. First of all, today is July 16th, and we are live in the studio. And if anyone who's a fan out there of Close Encounters and would like to ask Ray a question, or have read the book and want to ask him, feel free to call in. We have a toll-free number, which is 1-866-472-5795, 866-472-5795. We're going to be talking about Ray's book, which is when was this book released?
The book came out in November of last year.
November last year. Yeah. It's called Close Encounters of the Third Kind, The Making of Steven Spielberg's Classic Film. And you can find out more about it on raymorton.com or the link on my site, spiritoffilm.net. So why did you decide to write a book about this film?
Well, a few reasons, but the main reason was it's one of my all-time favorite films. I wrote a book about the different King Kong films that came out a few years ago, and my publisher and I were talking about doing a follow-up, because that book came out and did pretty well, and the idea came around to what movie would you really want to write about. And nobody had ever written a book fully about the making of Close Encounters. There have been biographies of Steven Spielberg that have mentioned it. There have been lots of magazine articles, or more from the time than now, and a few books about from actors who were in the film who talked about their experiences. But nobody had ever done a soup-to-nuts book about the creation of the entire film. And I love to know about the history of movies that I'm a fan of. And I thought I'd love to read a book like that about that movie, and I never saw one. So I thought, well, maybe this is the next topic to focus on. And my publisher liked the idea as well, at Applause Books, and that's how it started, really.
Well, Close Encounters again came out in 1977, 30 or so years ago, and it's a film that, along with Star Wars, really changed the industry. It was the first, actually, kind of what I would say, first real Spielberg movie. He had done Sugarland Express and Jaws before that, but this is a film that he conceived and started off and originated it. And he had several writers work on it. And I have to say, Ray, you've done an amazingly great job of research and interviewing and reconstructing how this film actually came to be. And because it went through so many different, a very long and winding road,
yes,
to get this movie made. And also at the time, there was the whole Columbia scandal with David Beagleman and all, yes, that. And that kind of, weaves into the story as well. If anyone's ever read the book Indecent Exposure, which came out many years ago, about that. So Close Encounters was also a film that was groundbreaking in terms of special effects. And I think it was kind of the penultimate movie that used a lot of the traditional style of motion picture effects, such as miniatures and process photography and optical work and so forth. And it really kind of took that to, the ultimate, before really CGI kind of took over, yeah, to a great degree, special effects in the industry. So What do you see besides those aspects? And of course, it was the beginning of Steven Spielberg's career. What do you see as far as the film itself? What does it represent in the history of motion pictures to you?
Well, I think, I mean, you touched on quite a few of, I think, the key points to it. Obviously, I agree absolutely with your interpretation. It's the first the real first Steven Spielberg film that touches on the things that have popped up in all of his movies since, or most of his movies. It was a revolutionary film in terms of special effects. I think, too, what it was and why it was so significant at the time that it came out. And nowadays, we don't remember this so much. But, you know, Hollywood had gone through a period where movies had become kind of downers. There was a sort of a gritty look at the world. Realism was the main idea of films from the late 60s through the mid-1970s. And it was a tough time. There was a recession. There were fuel problems. There was a lot of political scandals, Watergate maybe being the most. People had lost a lot of faith in things. And, you know, Star Wars came out in May of 1977, and it was such a breath of fresh air because it was just fun. People kind of forget now with all the movies that have come since. The original film was just so much fun, and it was a throwback to a more popular era. And then Close Encounters came along, and the thing I think is so significant about Close Encounters is whatever else the movie is about, it is about really the power of believing in something. And the movie is about a man who becomes so obsessed by his belief that he pretty much jettisons every aspect of his life to find the core of what this belief is. And in the end, he's rewarded for it in really a wonderfully positive way. When the aliens come out of the ship at the end of Close Encounters, it's a wonderful, beautiful moment. And I think that positive view of things was such a needed tonic to what had been going on at that time in history and at that time in films. And I think even more than Star Wars, it was significant for that reason, Close Encounters. The other thing about it is it was a time of great tension among many factions in the world, and what Close Encounters said was, when we meet the thing that scares us the most, it's going to turn out to be friendly and beautiful. And that was such a needed message at that time, too. So I think that's it. Aside from its wonderful craftsmanship, I mean, Spielberg, you know, arguably never directed better. The visual effects, the cinematography by Vilmos Zsigmond, you know, all of the technical things were just perfect. But I really think it's the spirit of the movie that really made it something special.
Yeah, at the time when I saw the film, I saw it, I think, in the first day or two that it came out, and I remember waiting about 5 hours in line at the Cinerama Dome Theater in Hollywood, where it was originally released. And it really did have a powerful impact on audiences, you know, that were wanting to believe in something, you know, a contact with extraterrestrial beings that was positive. And a film had really never had been done about that before. I mean, there's, of course, classic films like Day of the Earth Just Stood Still, which I've had Michael Phillips on the show talking about that, who was one of the producers of this movie.
One of Michael's favorite movies. Absolutely.
Yeah, and we talked about that some months ago. So if you want to check out the interview I did with Michael Phillips, who is one of the producers on Close Encounters, it's in my archives. And we did talk about Close Encounters a little bit. But I really saw that, you know, Star Wars got people excited about going to the movies again, I think, in a big way. And it also ushered in, again, the era of blockbuster films in Hollywood. Yeah. That's another aspect of it that we haven't touched on yet. So it made a lot of money, just like Star Wars did. So you had two films come out in the same year, which Hollywood started to see that, gee, movies can really make this much money. Okay, so now they kept looking for certain types of scripts that would, you know, maybe really take off like this. So it was also a renaissance for the science fiction film, which, you know, was still kind of floundering, both Star Wars and Close Encounters. And we also have a caller on the line from, I think, Los Angeles. And caller, are you there?
Hello.
Hi. Can you introduce yourself, and what's your question for Ray Morton today?
This is Pony Horton calling.
Hi, Pony.
How are you?
Okay.
And hello, Ray. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Quick little fun story about Close Encounters before I go to my question. and Randall can fill you in further should he decide to. Close Encounters was responsible for starting a 30-year relationship with someone that I still love very much to this day. Years and years ago, in early 78 or somewhere around there, I was taking a long walk up a hill to see a friend. It was a very hot day, and my friend wasn't home. But this woman from two houses down came up to say hello to me and ask, are you here to see this particular person? I said, yes. And she said, well, he's not home right now, but you look pretty hot and sweaty, like you've walked up that hill. Would you like to come into the house for some lemonade? And I was kind of shy, and I was like, no, who are you? I don't know you. And she said, do you like movies? And I said, yeah. She goes, well, I got Close Encounters in there. I went, okay. And we've been lovers and friends for 30 years now, thanks to Close Encounters.
That's a great little story. So what's your question?
My question is this. In terms of script writing and in terms of lines, Spielberg has gone through about three variations of Close Encounters in terms of re-editing and re-release.
Right.
And in all the releases I have seen, I have never seen a reinstatement of one of my all-time favorite lines in that movie. It's a line on the part of Roberts Blossom. It's just after we first see the spaceships come roaring around the hill, almost running over Roy Neary and the little boy, Barry. And then the cop cars come chasing around a moment later, and then we cut to Roberts Blossom, and he says, they can run rings around the moon, but we're years ahead of them on the highway.
Right.
And they've not reinstated that in any of the versions I've seen since. Do you know if this is going to be ever reinstated? And why was that line removed?
I'm not sure specifically why the line was removed. I think Spielberg had some second thoughts about a number of things. Do you have the new DVD collection that was put out last November, the 30th anniversary collection?
No, I do not have that one. I had the one that was released just prior to that, about a year or so prior to that.
Right. We'll pick that one up because in November, Sony put out a terrific version of the movie. It's all three edits of the film on the same collection, and they have the original theatrical cut, which has never been available on home video. After the first release of the film in 1977, that cut was withdrawn and has never been seen again. That's the one with the line in it that you like, and it's on the new collection, so pick it up.
Ray, and also in your book, you have a chapter 27, which is Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, which goes into all the different versions and DVD and VHS versions of the film and television showings of it as well. So I remember seeing a version on television that was... it had things in it that I'd never seen Close Encounters before. And, of course, in subsequent releases, some of those sequences were edited back into the film. And during this time when, between the initial release of the film and also its first resurrection with the extra scene at the end with Roy actually going inside the spaceship, I had a chance to actually meet Steven Spielberg out when he was shooting 1941 in the desert. And Pony, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
And Pony and I actually had a chance to work on one of the process shots for 1941
at Grand Air
Photo Effects.
we were responsible for searchlights over Hollywood and the San Fernando Valley during the plane chase between Wild Bill and Tim Matheson.
Oh, excellent.
So one of the questions that I asked them at that time, I said, why are you re-editing Close Encounters? Because, it's a great movie. Are you making a new version? He said... And my recollection of the answer that Spielberg gave, who was very, very pleasant, I just walked up to him on the set with a friend, and he kind of sat down and just talked with us. He's a pretty cool guy. And I remember his answer to that question was said that, well, my movies are sort of the way I feel about movies, that they're never done.
Yes.
And I remember that answer. He said, they're never done. And I'm like, okay. And... I remember him saying that. So Close Encounters was a film that, of course, was amazing in many ways. And, of course, it touched the world and I think is still very popular today. And looking at the history of great motion pictures, and we're going to be doing some retrospectives on some other motion pictures, such as 2001 A Space Odyssey and Day of the Earth Stood Still in this program in upcoming weeks. Ray, what do you feel the movie, talking to all the people who made the film, what was What was the sort of overall experience? Did they understand that they were creating a classic movie at the time, and what did they feel about the subject matter? Because UFOs had really never been explored factually and represented in a straightforward way in motion pictures before. Was everyone sort of excited about making this movie, or did they see the vision of it, or did they have opinions about, you know, Spielberg, because he was still a very young director? Sort of, what was a consensus of things that you got out of doing interviews for for making and writing of this book?
Right. The overall impression, and I was actually really delighted with this, because I've interviewed people about other films that I've been a really big fan of, and sometimes you hear people say, oh, I couldn't stand working on that movie, or it was a terrible experience, and things like that. Almost everybody I talked to had nothing but good things to say about the experience. It is, for most of the people, still one of the highlights of their career. I would kind of want to split my answer into two different parts, because the people who worked on the film, the actual physical production of the live-action part, I think some of them were not clear on... I mean, I don't think anyone thought they were working on a classic film, but they were hoping that they were working on a really cool film and a really fun film. Most of the people, the main people, were very young, so they had kind of an enthusiasm. You know, UFOs were big at the time in terms of pop culture, and Spielberg had just come off of Jaws, and he was really considered a phenomenon, you know, as he still is, but that was the first really blast of it. So people were really excited about things like that. And they liked the script, they liked what the movie had to say, they loved the idea of the sort of the peaceful encounter. So they were very enthusiastic from that point of view. The actual physical shoot was very, very difficult. It was a very grueling shoot. I cover it a lot in the book, but people have probably heard stories. Most of the film was shot in an old airplane hangar in Mobile, Alabama, in the height of the summer. And so it was incredibly hot and incredibly just grueling on a physical level. So, that's sort of the thrust. People said, we really liked the idea of the movie. They really liked working for Spielberg, who was really in the first flush of his powers at that time, but who even people who, you know, some people had a better experience than others, but everyone said he was just so full of imagination, constantly generating ideas. And people have said, you know, some of them were great, some of them were terrible, but it didn't matter. He just continually had these great ideas, and he would change things at the last minute just to make a better shot. People were all very enthusiastic about that. You know, they would prefer better physical conditions, but they could only do what they were going to do. You know, the visual effects were the second half of the production, and those guys were terrific. I mean, they're just wonderful people. But they said that they really didn't know what the movie was about, because a few of them had read the script, but not many of them. And they were not really sure. Someone said, we didn't know if we were working on like a great movie or, you know, a cheesy Earth versus the Flying Saucers ripoff. We just had no idea. But they were led by two really brilliant visual effects men, Douglas Trumbull and Richard Jurasich. And their allegiance was really to doing a great job for those guys who are just visionary. And they wanted to make the best special effects ever. And then when they finally saw the film, they're like, oh, this is what we've been working on for the last year. And they loved it. So,
in your interview with Richard Jurasich, who was the director of photography for the photographic effects work on the film, what was his sort of recollections about what they did that was innovative on this movie, or that was, you know, how did they refine some of the old processes and introduce some new processes in effects work?
Right. Well, the big innovation in both Star Wars and Close Encounters was, you know, none of the techniques were particularly brand new. I mean, people had shot models before, they had shot miniatures before, and things like that. And there had been mats and matte paintings and things like that. The real innovations in terms of what their approach was that they used a lot of computer-controlled cameras, what we now know as motion control. Star Wars and Close Encounters were the first to really make use of a fully developed version of that concept. They had kind of started with 2001, but that was a much more primitive system. So, and what that means is when you photograph a model, you don't move the model, you move the camera. And the motion of the camera when the film is projected gives you the impression that the model is moving. That was an old technique. By computerizing the camera to be able to exactly repeat every move of the camera, they could shoot not just one take of the model, but multiple takes of the model and never get it out of alignment. So the picture would never look fuzzy. It would always look perfect. And what that allowed them to do was add layer upon layer of lighting effects and surface effects and all sorts of little blurs and things to make the whole thing look much more realistic. You know, old movies using models, you can always tell they're models, because they could only be lit under one condition, and it never replicated what something would look like in reality. The motion control allowed them to add so much more detail to the whole process that the visual effects, as anyone who's ever seen Close Encounters know, are incredibly realistic. So that was sort of the one innovation. The other really big innovation, which was a hallmark of any visual effects that Douglas Trumbull or Richard Jurcich worked on, was they shot everything on 65mm film. Most film is shot, most regular live-action material is shot on 35mm film. By shooting on such a large format, they were able to create visual effects that when those effects were copied to be cut into the movie, which all visual effects have to do, there was much less of a reduction in visual in the image. Usually when you reproduce a piece of film, it gets grainier and grainier and grainier. By starting with a bigger image, the grain was much less, so they cut pretty flawlessly into the final cut, so you don't notice when the effects are coming on. Previous to that, there would always be a slight change in the image, which would always cue the audience into knowing that something fake was about to happen. Didn't happen in Close Encounters, and that was another amazing innovation of that film.
On the release of Close Encounters, they started, there was, I remember at the time, because of, I think, first of all, Star Wars, but in the way that films are marketed and products that came out of Close Encounters, and there was, you actually have pictures of some of them. I remember I got one of the little figures in the book and everything else, but there was a big shift in 77 to 78 that I remember in terms of the ancillary market in films. And Close Encounters was a pretty big part of that, of course, in Star Wars as well.
Yes.
But really, I started to see that the way that motion pictures were talked about in the public consciousness, and I think it kind of started with Jaws and the whole blockbuster phenomenon, that started to change in Hollywood, and you cover a little bit of that in your book. So if you just, you know, talk about that aspect of the movie after it came out, because it went through kind of several different phases of its marketing campaign.
Yes. Well, what Star Wars had shown the previous summer and then Close Encounters built on, prior to that, marketing or merchandising, I guess I should say, was not considered a major part of movie marketing. What you usually had was a poster, and you would find ways to promote it. Television advertising, by the way, was very new at that point. Jaws was really the first movie to do saturation advertising on television, which was a major change in marketing. And then Close Encounters and Star Wars followed that up. But merchandising was always considered an afterthought. And Michael Phillips, the producer of Close Encounters, gave me a great insight on that. You know, in this era, movies last in the movie theater 3 to 4 weeks, maybe. And then their next big appearance is on DVD, which is usually not very long after the film appears in the theater. Back then, a film contractually had two releases. A film would be released whenever it was released, and then it would play out. And that playing out usually took anywhere from 4 to 6 months to a year. So a movie could be in theaters first run, second run, third run, for up to a year. And then it would go on the shelf for a while, maybe a year and a half, and then it would be re-released. And it would play again in theaters, you know, back on the big screen, that kind of thing. And then after that, maybe a year or two after that, it would finally show up on television. And that was the end of a movie's life. And what Michael said was that merchandising in those days was designed as a way of keeping the movie alive in the public's memory. So a lot of merchandising didn't come out until well after the film was in the theater. There's a wonderful book they put out. It's a book of pictures from Close Encounters called, a document of the film. It's called Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a document of the film. And it's just wonderful pictures on set and some of the visual effects. That didn't come out till November of 1978, almost a year after the film hit theaters. What Star Wars showed and then Close Encounters built on was that people would buy the merchandise just for its own sake, as well as a keepsake of the film. And then that started this thing where you could spin off all of these different products, and they really became a thing on their own, not just a way of keeping the movie in promotion. And Close Encounters had great things. They had record albums and novels and a great little bendy E.T. character and frisbees and belt buckles and just all sorts of crazy things. It was so much fun in those days.
Yeah, I remember a lot. I actually had one of the original programs for a long time, and you show a picture of it in your book, that little fold-out thing that I went to one of the advanced screenings that we got. The film represents also, besides, as I mentioned, in special effects and movie history, it represents, as you said, a shift in the attitude of the public. I think it was the first sort of spiritual science fiction film, besides maybe you could give that label to 2001 A Space Odyssey, but it was more accepted by the public, and of course the sort of afterthought by Spielberg, or the sort of sequel, I don't really look at it as a sequel, but was E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which took the idea of the character that you see at the end doing sign language with Francois Truffaut's character. I think that idea was born out of Close Encounters, and you mentioned something about that in the book, so that resulted in E.T., and of course that film was, I think, maybe even bigger internationally, and of course in people's memories in terms of the sci-fi and a spiritual kind of a story. So with these two films together, I see that there's a relationship and there's a track looking at movies which I would call spiritual science fiction, of course. And now we've had, in the course of since the late 70s and early 80s, we've seen a number of those. And later this year, The Day the Earth Stood Still is being re-released in a new version. So, and I've seen a change, and we've talked about that change in Hollywood, of making movies like The Last Mimsy, which Michael Phillips also produced, and having films that are about a message that could be, you know, that it's beyond sort of talks about who we are and why we're here and that kind of an idea. Do you think that that Hollywood has recognized that this idea of making films with sort of a more of a message in them is becoming or more of an accepted trend?
It's interesting. I think it goes in waves. I think after Close Encounters, you know, before Close Encounters, those kind of movies usually were very grim. They were basically horror films. You know, aliens would come and kill you, and you would fight back, and you would kill them, and that would be the end of it. Close Encounters, you know, Day the Earth Stood Still, the alien was much more of the positive protagonist, but he was still there to give you a warning, which is, if you don't shape up, we're going to deal with you guys. Close Encounters made it into something a little more spiritual. You know, I agree with you, 2001 as well. And then, of course, that led to E.T., and once E.T. came in, then that positivity really became the standard for alien life. I mean, you had movies like Starman and things like that where it was assumed that a presence from another world would be a positive one and that the encounters would be more spiritual. I think that went away for a while. We kind of turned back to sort of dark and nasty in science fiction for a long time. I think the Matrix movies revived it a little bit, or at least the first one, where there was a little kind of an oddball spirituality to it that I think really grabbed people's attention. But I think right now Hollywood is so interested in just plain spectacle that if someone worked that in, they would, but I don't know if they're looking for it as much as they were in the years after Close Encounters and E.T. Personally, I wish they would more, you know.
with the advent of CGI today, it's easy to make a movie that looks big, and we've seen a lot of that. Well, we're getting to the close of our show. Ray, I really want to thank you being on today and talking about both the craft of screenwriting and, of course, Close Encounters. And if you want to find out more about Ray's work and get a copy of the book, you can go to my website, spiritoffilm.net, or raymorton.com. Ray, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Well, everyone, again, that's a wrap for our show for this week. Join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. I'd like to thank our engineers in the studio and, of course, the Catfish Groove Farm for our theme music. You can find out more about their really cool tunes at catfishgroovefarm.com. And, of course, you can find out more on the Internet about Spirit of Film Conversations by going to my website at spiritoffilm.net. And please tell your friends about where to find our program right here on SeventhWaveNetwork.com. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Libero for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.